So good to be with you tonight. If you would, please open up your Bibles to Job chapter 19, where we'll begin in just a moment. So good to see many faces that have been out already for the three times that we've been assembled, and others that are visiting for the first time tonight. Appreciate your attendance here. Hope that the things that we'll do this evening will bring us closer to one another and closer to the Lord. That's my hope and my prayer. In Job chapter 19, beginning at verse 23, "Oh, that my words were written, oh, that they were inscribed in a book, that they were engraved on a rock with an iron pen and lead forever. For I know that my Redeemer lives, and he shall stand at last on the earth. And after my skin is destroyed, this I know, that in my flesh I shall see God." Powerful, powerful verse that we're going to spend some time in this evening. But as I was getting ready to stand up here, I was thinking about 32 years ago, as the fall meeting was approaching here in Payton City, I was visiting, and there were 10 weeks that I had started at the plant and was working there, but Gene and the family hadn't come yet. And it was during that time, Brother Kent Yeager invited me, and he said, "We're having a gospel meeting, and we'd like you to come." And I said, "Well, Ken, I'm not a member here. Y'all go ahead and have your meeting and decide whatever you have to decide, and then, you know, that'll be fine." And he looked at me for a minute, and I looked at him for a minute. And he said, "Well, it's not that kind of a meeting." And I said, "Oh, really?" He said, "No, it's going to be preaching." "Well, oh, okay. Well, I could come to that." And so I agreed to come to that. But as Monday night came around, I was a little put out because I'd already given Sunday morning what I figured I could give that week. You know, we had a foot in each canoe. They had a house up there, and I was living down here, and I didn't have a lot of extra money for the love offering that I was just sure was going to be. You know, every time a church gets together, there's a love offering. So I scraped together a couple extra dollars and had it in my pocket, and I was just thrilled when I got to the end of that service, and nobody had asked for it. And I couldn't believe They got together, and they didn't ask me for a thing. And that was great. And I thought I was free and clear until I got home back to the Sistersville Inn, I guess the hotel down there. And I called Jean, and she said, "Now, where have you been? I've been trying to reach you." I said, "Well, I was at church." "On a Monday?" Nobody goes to church on a Monday. We were so new. We didn't have any idea. It took a long time to get into the swing of how we are very accustomed to doing things now, but it was very, very new to us at one point. And so that was, I just wanted to share that with you about how this idea of a gospel meeting originally struck me. I want to go with you tonight to a very serious topic, the problem of human suffering. There are times when I'm with groups and I talk about this, and I feel like I need to get pretty creative to try to illustrate the suffering that individuals can feel. But when I come here, I don't feel like I've got to tell you too much. I think you've been intimately aware of people, you know people who have suffered and suffered greatly. It's a problem everywhere. It's a problem here. Did you know that a lot of folks struggle with the problem of human suffering? They struggle to get an answer for why it happens. And many of those, not getting a satisfactory answer, not only turn their back on organized religion, but they'll turn their back on God too. And you'll find a number of people that will say, "If a God would allow that kind of thing to happen, well, I'm not going to believe in him. And I don't respect him." You'll hear that sometimes. And maybe you've even heard it. Maybe this isn't just something I'm coming up with, but you've heard people say that. The problem of human suffering is a very real problem. And to have a good answer is an important thing, I think. But the Bible provides us a wonderful answer in the book of Job. The problem is, it's 42 chapters long. And it's written in a style that we're not quite used to. And it takes some work to get in there and to get the full message that God intends us to have about the problem of human suffering. And there have been a number of times that I've been trying to comfort those who are in the midst of a severe and an either acute or chronic affliction, and have told them about the solace that's available in the book of Job, but in the throes of that trial, whatever it is, that affliction that they're in, they don't have perhaps the tools, they don't have the focus, they don't have the patience to delve in and get the whole message at that time. And so this great message that the Lord has provided for us about the problem of human suffering goes by. They just can't tap into it at that time. And I guess the lesson for that is, we better understand the book of Job before the suffering comes upon us, so we're prepared for it. And I think that is an important lesson. I gave you a lot of material last night. I told you it was going to be like getting a drink of water out of a 3-inch fire hose. It was a little bit like that. Some of you told me that. But I haven't learned a thing. We're going to try to do the whole book of Job tonight. But after I said it before you and try to explain it to you, get the point out of it, I want to come back to this section that we just read and show you the amazing application of what Job mentioned in passing in chapter 19. Let's take a look at the book of Job. And again, this is something it'll be hard to take notes on, but the introduction to the book, chapter 1, verses 1 through 5, we have presented in the distilled essence that only the Spirit can do so effectively, the character of this man, Job. And it's stellar. It's a stellar character. He's doing very, very well. By God's own evaluation, he says, "Have you found a man like, or, you know, here's this man, and here's how wonderful he is." Now, his reward for that, or the follow-through for that, is being used as an object lesson at God's suggestion for Satan to learn something. He says, "Satan, now how do you explain a man like this who does the right thing and serves me? How do you explain a good man?" And his first attempt at explaining is to say, "Well, you know, he's in it for the stuff. You've given him a lot of stuff, and guys will do things for stuff. And so, you know, that's why Job serves you. But if you take all his stuff away, he won't serve you anymore." And so that's a malicious comment. It's ascribing an evil motive to a good action. And Satan does that without any, you know, thought about saying something like that. And just to test that theory, God allows him, permits him to afflict him by taking his stuff, his children, his possessions. And Satan does that without seemingly any reservation at all. He just sweeps in. And in the first affliction, he loses everything as the four corners of the winds from the four corners blow upon him, and he loses all, really. But we don't see him curse God as Satan predicted. We see him hold fast to his integrity. And so Satan is proved wrong. And what he said about Job was not true. So in the second meeting, God says, "Well, what do you say now? You weren't right the first time. How do you explain a good man like Job?" And Satan says, "Well, he's in it for his health. People will do a lot of things to have good health, and you've given him good health. But if you take away his health, he won't serve you anymore." And God says, "Well, then you go ahead and check that out too. With the reservation that you can't kill him, you can afflict him as you see fit." And so Satan struck Job with terrible boils from the top of his head to the bottom of his feet and left him first completely devastated economically and relationship-wise, and then afflicted. And I've never been so bad off that it felt good to scrape myself with a piece of broken pottery. But he said that helped him feel better, to scrape himself with that. And I can't imagine that. And he's there. And in the second affliction, He holds fast again to his integrity, and he does not curse God. But keep in mind, Job hasn't had any information about why he's being afflicted or who's doing it. And so with that, we enter into the part of the book, I guess the body of the book. At the last part of chapter 2, his friends arrive, and for the first 7 days, they're quiet, and that's the best they ever do at comforting him. When they start opening their mouths, it gets worse. But we find out that Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar show up, and then they enter in, well, after Job's lament in chapter 3, they enter into the first of three rounds. And I think when you're trying to understand the book of Job, understanding the flow of it really helps. And it's a very formal flow. Eliphaz speaks to Job. Job answers him. Bildad speaks to Job. Job answers him. Zophar speaks to Job. Job answers him. End of round one. And then we go and we do that again for round two. And then we go and do that again for round three. And you can follow through and see all the things that these fellows say. But and that's a good exercise to do. Go through round one, go through round two, go through round three. A caution to my fellow preachers that are here, and you know this already, but just a reminder, you can't just go to the book of Job and pull something out and quote it and use it. There are a lot of times in there that what the people are saying isn't right. It doesn't agree with what God says. There's information that we have now as readers that they didn't have, and they were guessing. The main problem in the book is that all these people I've pictured on the screen, not God, but the men, all believe in the theology of retribution, which is the idea that good things happen to good people and bad things happen to bad people. And it's pretty black and white that way. And there aren't exceptions to the rule. Now, when Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar say it to Job and about Job, their direct accusation is, Job, you're suffering because of all the wrong that you've done. As a matter of fact, at one point they say, and you're not even getting what you deserve. You've done more. And you deserve a lot worse from God. Which we know is not the case because we read the introduction. God held him up as a great person. So his friends are actually no encouragement at all as they're accusing him of things he has not done. Job's understanding that good things happen to good people and bad things happen to bad people is that God's doing this to me by mistake. He's put me down in the naughty column, if you will, and he's punishing me for that, and I need to talk to him. I need to talk to God and straighten him out. And he says that at one point. Let me find that for you. It's, I think, in chapter 22, 23. Chapter 23, as Job is really feeling the weight of all this loss and all this affliction, and all this physical torment. In chapter 23, verse 2, he says, even today my complaint is bitter. My hand is listless because of my groaning. Oh, that I knew where I might find him. That's God he's talking about. I need to find God that I might come to his seat. I would present my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I'd know the words which he would answer me and understand what he would say with me. Would he contend with me in his great power? No, but he would take note of me. There an upright could reason with him, and I would be delivered from my judge forever. Do you believe that? We talk a lot about the patience of Job, but Job got hot, and he got bothered, and he said, if I could just get a hold of God, I'd straighten him out, because he's made a mistake here. I'd come before him, and I'd tell him a thing or two. You remember that he said that for when we get to the latter part of the book, but he gets his request. He's kind of sorry he did. After the third round, we get a glimpse that there's somebody that's been there all along, but we didn't know. His name was Elihu. He seems to be younger than the other fellows, and he's been listening the whole time, but he hasn't spoken until now. And so he speaks up after the end of the third round, and he tries to explain how things are. He does okay. He doesn't do great. He does a little better, I think, than the other guys, but he still doesn't get to the bottom line. Chapter 38, God speaks to Job. And he doesn't say, now, Joby, let's talk. Nice tones. He answers him out of the whirlwind. And every time I say answers him out of the whirlwind, I want to slap the lectern. But I did it once, and I saw a bunch of pacemakers react, you know, and the people, oh. But that's how God answered him, out of the hurricane or the tornado. He didn't come to him all nice and cuddly. He says, now I'm going to ask you some questions. Let's turn there, chapter 38, and see how it is that God spoke to Job when he got his chance to come before him and make his case. God doesn't give him a chance to talk first. He starts to ask him a bunch of rhetorical questions. But first, he says, who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? And you got to know right away, he thought this was a bad idea. I might have slipped up here, but in verse 3, now you prepare yourself like a man, and I'll question you. You answer me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. And you know he's thinking this is a bad idea. Well, now this goes on for a while. And after he's done, in chapter 40, the Lord kind of winds up here and says, shall the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? He who rebukes God, let him answer it. And Job says to the Lord, behold, I'm vile. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand over my mouth. Once I have spoken, but I will not answer. Yes, twice, but I will proceed no further. And does God say at that point, well, Job, we're okay now? No, he answers him out of the whirlwind again, and he comes right back at him. And he says, now prepare yourself like a man, and I'll question you. You'll answer me. And he goes right on, and he asks him again. You know what? The Lord never explains to him exactly why this has come upon him. He just basically communicates it. You don't have any right to question me or how I run things. You've got no right. And Job finally gets that point after God speaks to him the second time. He answers very politely in chapter 42. I know that you can do everything and that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. You asked, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Listen, please, and let me speak. You said, I will question you, you shall answer me. I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore, I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. And then the close of the book, Job is restored to health. And he's actually restored. I mean, he can't get the same children back, but he gets blessed with basically twice what he had in the first place. But he never, unless this book was written, like he got his request in his time, he never did get to see exactly why he had to suffer all of those things. It's an amazing book. And there's an amazing application for us, I think. We really don't have any right to question how God's doing things. And we talk about, the Bible talks about chance. Time and chance happen to all men. I think it's Ecclesiastes 9 and 11, might be 10. For us, chance is when the cause is so far removed from the effect that we can't see it. Something caused this, but I don't know what it is. And when we get in the midst of a situation like that, an affliction like that, and we start to question how God does things, we've got to realize, like Job did, we've got no right to ask that. We've got no right. It might not be that we'll ever see the answer to this, but we're just going to keep on serving Him and trust that He's got a plan and we're part of it. And we're just going to do our part and suffer through whatever we have to. But you know, in this book, there are a lot of questions that Job asks that he never gets an answer to, that never get answered for him. But those questions are answered for us in the New Testament. And it's pretty amazing. If you go back to that passage where we start, I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been thus destroyed, yet in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold, and not another. And at the thought of that, he said, my heart faints within me. Dear ones, do you realize what's being mentioned there? Think about it. After my skin has been thus destroyed, now that's talking about death. After my skin has been destroyed, after I die, yet in my flesh I shall see God. Dear ones, that's talking about a resurrection. That's one of the earliest things we have in the Bible about resurrection, I think, and that's what it's referring to. After I die, yet in my flesh I'm going to see God. And I know that my Redeemer lives. Now, he didn't know the details of his Redeemer, what his name was, how he was going to come, when he was going to come. He just says this great statement of faith. I know that my Redeemer lives, as we were just singing. And thanks so much for choosing that song. It was a great song to lead into this. In the Old Testament, the idea of Redeemer could mean a number of different things. There were a number of different scenarios in which it applied. It could mean you need to purchase something. It could mean that you need to ransom someone. Or it could mean that you were going to avenge someone who had been treated spitefully or wronged in some way. Let me show you some examples for that. In Exodus chapter 13, beginning in verse 11, it shall be when the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites, as he swore to you and your fathers, and gives it to you, that you shall set apart to the Lord all that open the womb, that is, every firstling that comes from an animal which you have. The males shall be the Lord's. But every firstling of a donkey you shall redeem with a lamb. And if you will not redeem it, you'll break its neck. And all the firstborn of man among your sons you shall redeem. So it shall be when you come, when your son asks you in time to come, saying, what is this? That you shall say to him, by strength of hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. And it came to pass when Pharaoh was stubborn about letting us go that the Lord killed all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of man and the firstborn of animal. Therefore, I sacrifice to the Lord all males that open the womb, but all the firstborn of my sons I redeem. It shall be a sign on your hand and as frontlets between your eyes, for by strength of hand the Lord brought you out of Egypt. What he's saying is, because of the deliverance that the Lord brought about for the children of Israel, every firstborn was his. Whether it was of an animal or of a human, the firstborn male was his. It belonged to him. If you wanted to keep it, you needed to pay for it with something else. And that was redeeming. And that's one way, with the animals or with the humans, that firstborn needed to be kind of bought back because it belonged to the Lord in the first place. Over in the book of Leviticus, chapter 25, there are a couple of different illustrations of redemption. Over on the right on the screen, chapter 25 and verse 25, if one of your brethren becomes poor and has sold some of his possessions, if his kinsman redeemer comes to redeem it, that he may redeem what his brother has sold. So you could buy back that which has been sold in a time of poverty. And that was called redemption. And that's kind of like an economic transaction, just to buy back something that had been sold. Skipping over to verses 47 through 49, if a sojourner or a stranger chose or close to you becomes rich, and one of your brethren who dwells by him becomes poor and sells himself to the stranger or the sojourner close to you or to a member of the stranger's family, after he is sold, he may be redeemed again. If you sell yourself, then you can redeem or be redeemed by somebody, be bought back. And then skipping over to Leviticus 27, verses 11 through 13, it talks there about something that has been dedicated to the Lord. You can redeem that thing as well. I'm not going to take time to look at that. But all these three things across the bottom, it could imply just kind of a purchase of a thing. or the ransom of a person, or avenging someone. Redemption applied to all those different things in the Old Testament. The greatest example of redemption in the Old Testament is the Exodus. In Exodus chapter 6 and verse 6, it talks in prospect about how God was going to redeem his children who had been enslaved wrongfully in Egypt. And it says in advance, he's going to do this thing. And then in chapter 15, verse 13, standing on the other side of the Red Sea, having been delivered in the song of Moses, it talks about how God had redeemed his people. And then after that, many times after that, you'll see a remembrance of this great deliverance. It was the greatest deliverance, the greatest redemption in the Old Testament time. So it's brought back to memory. Deuteronomy 15 and verse 15, Moses reminds the generation that had been raised up in the wilderness that they had been redeemed. And another great example of redemption in the Old Testament is the book of Ruth, where Boaz is chosen as the near kinsman redeemer. And he says, well, there's another closer, and we've got to settle that. But then the idea is that he can redeem Ruth and Naomi's property. So those are the greatest examples in the Old Testament of redemption. And they really cover those three different ways that you could be redeemed. The Redeemer was expected, as we started in the book of Job, chapter 19, verses 25 and 27. And even as we draw closer, you know, Job is one of the oldest books, or talking about a very old time in the Old Testament. As we get closer to the New Testament, in prophecy, we can see that they're still looking forward to the time that the Redeemer would come. And here, Isaiah 59 and verse 20, and a Redeemer will, future, come to Zion, to those in Jacob who turn from transgression, declares the Lord. And so as we get completed with the Old Testament, we see the expectation of this Redeemer coming. And so then comes Jesus of Nazareth. And it's amazing how many different ways and how completely he fulfills all the expectations for a Redeemer. In Galatians chapter 4, verses 3 through 5, in the same way, we also, when we were children, were enslaved to the elementary principles of the world. But when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, so that we might receive adoption as sons. He came to redeem us, to purchase us for himself. Again, in 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 17 through 19, to the idea of being ransomed. And if you call on him as Father who judges impartially according to each one's deeds, conduct yourself with fear throughout the time of your exile, knowing that you were ransomed from the futile ways inherited from your forefathers, not with perishable things such as silver or gold, but with the precious blood of Christ, like that of a lamb without blemish or spot. Jesus purchased us. Jesus ransomed us. And in a very real sense, Jesus avenged us as well. Here it says in 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, verses 7, through 7 and 8, talking about when the Lord's going to return, to grant relief to you who are afflicted as well to us, when the Lord Jesus is revealed from heaven with his mighty angels in flaming fire, inflicting vengeance on those who do not know God and on those who do not obey the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ. As we read in Revelation of the saints under the altar crying out, O Lord, how long? We understand that they will be avenged ultimately by the Lord at his return. Job, in the midst of his affliction, in the midst of his trial, knew that his Redeemer would come. He didn't know how, though, and at the close of his book, still a lot of his questions had not been answered and been answered sufficiently. But when we look back with what we have in the New Testament, we can tell exactly what he was looking forward to with great specificity. We can see that in Jesus of Nazareth, that Redeemer has come. And in every sense in which we could understand redemption in the Old Testament, he has fulfilled that in every way. And it's profound and it's amazing to see how completely Jesus has redeemed mankind. Job also knew that after he died, he would see God. After his death, he would see God. We need to know that too. I've been amazed how many folks have passed on since the last time I was here. And it just serves as a wake-up call. Not that we need many wake-up calls, but we realize that this time that we have is a gift, and it's short, and it ends abruptly. I think about those poor folks that were just worshiping that Sunday in Texas when the spray of bullets came. You just have no idea. And that means you got to be ready. And you got to be ready with this idea also that we're going to see God someday. And the reality that our Redeemer lives. And so the question I ask tonight in closing is, are you ready? Are you ready to be redeemed? Have you been redeemed already? And is there some fault that's got a hold of you that's just keeping you, separating you from God? Dear ones, why would we leave? Why would we take the chance of maybe getting another day? Why wouldn't we take care of it right now and be ready as Job was to meet the Lord in the after while? All things are ready, dear ones. We've got an invitation song. Turn to it, if you will. Which one was it? 321? 322. No better place to bring your broken life than to Jesus Christ, who is waiting to heal, waiting to mend. And truly all things are ready. And if you're subject to the call, won't you come now while we stand and while we sing?